Testing.
All right. Sorry, I had some technical difficulties. Good morning. Welcome to the BMOC hearing on Boys and Men of Color. I am Assemblymember Reginald Byron Jones Sawyer Sr., one of the chairs of the Assembly Select Committee on the Status of Boys and Men of Color. I represent the 59th Assembly District, which includes South Los Angeles, Walnut Park, Huntington Park, and Florence Firestone. My colleague, Mr. Bonta, will introduce himself after I say a few words. Obviously, I want to welcome everyone that are here in the gallery, and most important, the ones that are unfortunately unable to get into the gallery that are in the Eureka Room in the building, which I believe is about 200 young people and staff that are down there. I want to welcome you here to this hearing. The American Promise tells us that anyone born anywhere of any color or class can get an education, live in a healthy community, and be rewarded for their hard work. But this dream comes with hard-hitting realities. Too many young people, disproportionately young men of color, are trapped in a cycle of prison, poverty, and disadvantage. Deteriorated schools, neighborhoods, poor health, dysfunctional social support, and limited job opportunities hamper their progress. These circumstances leave communities in poverty, rob opportunity from our scholars of color, and make the far majority of Californians unable to compete in the professional workplace. Our young people are growing up without a fair shot to be healthy and successful. That's not the kind of community we want to create. Now more than ever, it's not enough to just lower the barriers that have for too long stifled the potential of our promising youth. It's time to break them. The good news is that programs and reforms have helped, but there is so much more to be done. We need to increase graduation rates, improve community health, stop criminalizing students, and above all, we need to renew our vows to our Black, Brown, and API youth. As I've said before, and I'll say it again, I am unapologetic when it comes to my support and my fight to improve the lives of boys and men of color in the state of California and this country. And I say I am unapologetic is because when others come and say, what if we slow the progress? What about this? What about that? I usually say, and always say, it's time is now. We need to stop procrastinating. We need to do a whole lot more for our young men and boys of color. Today is laced with more opportunities than in generations. I'm especially glad today when we hear from not only speakers who are knowledgeable, but probably the most important speakers will be young people. We made a conscious effort, my co-chair and I, Mr. Bonta, we made a conscious effort to hear from young people. More, all too often, we hear from our peers or people who are of the same age as we are. We need to start listening more to you because you are experiencing it more every day. You have more insight of what needs to be done. And most important, the impacts on you are much more dramatic than ever before. So for us as parents, I have two sons, one that's 22 and one that's 14, both have been impacted adversely by the educational system. Both have had difficulties dealing with racism on a level that is hidden. I call it passive-aggressive racism, where people have good intentions or systems have good intentions, but their outcomes have left our young people in a disadvantage and more or less have been racist to people of color. We need to stop it, and we need to do a whole lot more than we ever had before. For us as parents, as neighbors, as voters, and as policymakers, the greatest gift to our children is to ensure that everyone can access to a successful life. With that, I will turn it over to Mr. Bonta, the other chair of Boys and Men of Color.
Thank you, Chair Jones Sawyer, and welcome and good morning to everyone who has joined us for our hearing today. I just want to let you know how excited I am to be here with you. Most excited about the fact that we have so many amazing youth and youth leaders here in this room watching through the feed, participating today. That's the most important thing for me. I'm excited to hear from our agencies for sure, and they'll be in our first panel, but I'm really excited that on each panel we have the youth voice strong and loud. And I just want to thank you for your participation today. To all the youth, you're definitely the leaders of tomorrow, but you're the leaders of today. You're leaders, you're here, you're engaged. We're here to listen. We're here to learn from you. We're excited to hear your testimony today. And I just want to share how much I appreciate your engagement and your participation. I've been asked to make a quick logistical announcement. We please do not use cell phones for video or for taking pictures. And please put your cell phones on silence. And so you had a little moratorium there where if you were taking a video, it's cool. But now I made the announcement, we need to make sure no videos and no photos. So thank you for that. I'm really excited also today about our theme of free our dreams and having no restrictions or barriers as we envision what tomorrow will be and not being contained and constrained by some of the obstacles of the present. And so as we work together to continue to create more opportunities for our boys and men of color in work and in life and in school and in all areas, we should be guided by and inspired by our vision for what the future can be and not what it's been in the past and not what it is today, because we all know that we can successfully fight for a better future for all of our boys and men of color. And, you know, this is one of the most important hearings of the year because we get a good sense of what we've accomplished and how far we've come, because this select committee has been incredibly active. It's the select committee that sponsors and supports and gets the most legislation passed, that gets the most work in the communities done, and will continue. And we do that because we have amazing partners throughout the state working at grassroots levels in our communities, transforming them and improving them. So we're going to hear about that work today. And again, I appreciate your participation. I thank all of our amazing youth leaders for being here and look forward to taking part in this hearing with you. Thank you very much.
Good. So let us begin with our first panel, Agency Programs Addressing the Needs of Boys and Men of Color. Tim Rainey from the California Workforce Development Board, Jamal Miller, Office of Health Equity, and Christian Saunders, Division of Juvenile Facilities, Juvenile Acceptance and Community Release Accountability Office. I see Mr. Miller's here, Ms. Saunders here, and I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll begin with you two, and if Mr. Rainey shows up, we'll plug him right in. But since we have limited time, I want to make sure we don't miss anything. So, Mr. Miller, would you like to begin first?
Absolutely. Good morning to the both of you and everyone who's in attendance and also those virtually participating. I look forward to this annual convening. This is one of the highlights in serving in the Brown administration, to come and speak on an issue that I'm both personally and professionally passionate about with regards to boys and men of color. Just wanted to start out with a statistic with regard to the cost of health inequality from a health and mental health standpoint. Dr. Spencer Overton and Dr. Thomas Levice produced a study a couple of years ago out of the Joint Center on Political and Economic Studies that identifies the health inequality cost with regard to Asian, Pacific Islander, African American, and Latino communities between the years of 2003 through 2006 cost the United States roughly $1.24 trillion. And when you narrow that cost down to medical expenditures, direct medical expenditures, that cost is roughly $332 billion. So not only is this work socially redemptive and important for us to address with regard to systemic, institutional, and policy-oriented issues and opportunities, this is a very real economic opportunity for us to address, and oftentimes the numbers from a financial standpoint aren't addressed. So I wanted to lead with that. And specifically, out of the Office of Health Equity within the California Department of Public Health, I'd like to start with solutions with efforts that we're already engaged with. And then I'll identify some of the latest statistics that we are reporting out of our office and our demographic analysis, as well as out of our Healthy Communities Data and Indicator Project solutions. One of the efforts that we are now rolling out is the California Reducing Disparities Project, which is a Proposition 63 funded effort out of the Mental Health Services Act to invest in community-defined evidence practices across the state of California, roughly $60 million, to invest in statewide evaluation, technical assistance providers, and the bulk of the investment is going to implementation and capacity building projects and pilot projects themselves. And the intent is for us to take this funding and to intentionally not invest in evidence-based efforts. When we think about community-based organizations that are serving our communities well from a culturally congruent standpoint, but historically have not had the investment from state government or even private funders, nor have they had the appropriate infrastructure to strengthen the capacity of providing culturally congruent mental and behavioral health services to communities of color, as well as the LGBTQ community. The latest update that we have on the CRDP is that we have recently engaged and awarded our statewide evaluator contract to Loyola Marymount under the leadership of Principal Investigator Dr. Cheryl Grills. And they are playing a critical role given their mental and behavioral health expertise to ensure that we evaluate the effectiveness of these pilot projects that we are investing in over the next few years so that we can document the successes of how the $60 million is invested and ultimately hardwire and sustain our ability to support these community-based efforts that oftentimes go under-supported and their sustainability is always in question. And we believe that evaluating and documenting the effectiveness of these efforts is critical for the long-term life of these particular efforts. We have also identified five technical assistance providers that will work closely with each of our pods of pilot projects. So we have identified technical assistance providers for the Asian Pacific Islander community, the LGBTQ community, Native American, African American, as well as the Latino community. And these technical assistance providers are going to work closely with the pilot projects on efforts around administration, infrastructure, to ensure that the business facets of these community-based organizations and programs is strong, is vital, as they simultaneously are providing mental and behavioral health services to communities of color, as well as the LGBTQ community. And then thirdly, we have also identified the bulk of our pilot projects, a diverse array, a demographically diverse, geographically diverse array of providers in the community that have submitted proposals that range from strengthening our trauma-informed care systems, that range from addressing issues around adverse childhood experiences when we think about toxic stress and such, and an array of other efforts that are underway that you typically would not find funded. So we take a great deal of pride in our efforts to invest in capacity building and also to invest in the direct provision of some of these community-defined evidence practices and programs. The second effort I'd like to identify that we're engaged in is the innovative and creative work that's being led by our Health and All Policies Task Force, as well as our staff out of the Office of Health Equity, as well as within the Strategic Growth Council. We have an action plan that was just released through the Strategic Growth Council a few months ago with regard to building up community resilience and violence prevention. And it ranges from addressing the built environment and land use oriented decisions on the state, local, county, city levels to ensure that our built environment, ranging from land use, from policing, and a variety of facets of how we ensure and define what a healthy community is, our Health and All Policies Task Force and staff is being proactive and preemptive in rolling out this extensive action plan, which is made available to the public, to address a variety of the social determinant of health-oriented issues that keep many of our communities in a perpetual state of being underserved and disadvantaged. So our approach is not only to address downstream health and mental health inequities, but it's also focused on going upstream so that we can deal with the causes of the causes. What are the causes of the causes? The causes are solutions that provide sustainability and long-term plans for addressing the deeply rooted issues around health and mental health inequity. The issues that we are addressing is mortality rates, for instance. When we think of African American men, the 1.4, the African American male community has a mortality rate that's 1.4 times higher than that of the state average. When we compare that to white men, when we think about mortality rate by homicide, African American men are 5 times higher than the state average. Looking at other downstream statistics, when we think about men's health, diabetes diagnosis for Latino men, 1.3 times higher than the state average. Think about high blood pressure diagnosis, American Indian men, 1.3 times higher than the state average. And just a quick statistics, when we think about upstream poverty and education, child poverty, African American boys have 1.5 times higher the rate of the state average when we think about childhood poverty. High school dropout rate, African American male teens have 1.7 times higher the state average. The same goes for unemployment and earnings. Percent of unemployment, African American men ages 16 to 24, 1.6 times higher the state average. Median earnings, full-time workers, men of other races, the averages with regard to median earnings is much lower than the state average. So our approach in the Office of Health Equity and partnering with other departments and offices and agencies is to go upstream in addressing men's determinants of health as well as addressing downstream men's health, because we believe health is shaped by where we live, learn, work, play, and pray. I thank you for this opportunity to share an update.
Thank you. Mr. Rainey is here, so whenever you're ready.
I want to, Chairman Jones Sawyer, my honor to be here. I looked behind me am a bit overwhelmed, but mostly inspired by the energy around the Select Committee and the work that's being done by the Select Committee. I was walking up the hallway behind a large group of young people, and I heard somebody say, we have to go to the basement. I didn't come all this way to be in the basement. But it's too bad, but it's also just a testament to the energy around the work that's being done. For our part, I'm Tim Rainey, Executive Director of the California Workforce Development Board. I've been involved personally with Boys and Men of Color before I came to work at the state level when I was with the State Labor Federation in partnership with PolicyLink. So we are very concerned about equity, especially income mobility. But as we know, and we've talked about at the Select Committee hearings a number of times, equity is bigger, and that we've heard about just today on this panel. Equity is much bigger than job training or workforce development. It includes issues around housing, access to transportation, clean air, healthy communities, healthcare, access to healthcare, and the right kinds of health services. And then relative bargaining power, which is really a subject for the Labor Committee. But all those things together are crucial to equity. Our part is the job skills piece of that equation, that broader equation. So under the leadership of Secretary Lanier, the Labor Secretary in California, and the chair of the State Workforce Board, Mike Grassi, the State Board has been investing governor's discretionary funds. These are funds that come from the federal level connected to the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. And other sources of money to accelerate employment for populations with significant barriers to employment, including at-risk youth, low-income adults, unemployed, homeless, veterans, people with disabilities, and others. And the purpose of these investments is to achieve greater employment outcomes through innovation and scale and collaboration. So there are three main buckets that we invest in from the state level in cahoots with, I know that's an official term that's often used in committees, in partnership with the Employment Development Department, which jointly administers these programs for us. And these funds all go out in competitive applications. I should also mention that PolicyLink, a very important partner of ours, helps not only to develop and design these RFAs, but also helps to make sure that community-based organizations and advocates around the state know these dollars are out in the street, and then helping people to apply for the funds. So we do a lot of capacity work through PolicyLink. The three buckets are recidivism reduction. We get from the recidivism reduction fund intended to align workforce development with the community corrections partnerships, and then aligned with the realignment efforts at the county level. That's our supervised population workforce development training program, rather. The second one is Prop 39. We have a small amount of Prop 39 funds that we receive every year, and we have been developing multi-craft pre-apprenticeship programs that allow at-risk youth and veterans and low-income people access to state-approved apprenticeship programs that are connecting people to apprenticeship, registered apprenticeship slots on public works projects. We have an accelerator fund also, which provides innovation funding for local programs to develop new partnerships and approaches targeted to accelerating employment for populations with barriers to employment. The more fun part, that's very fun, but the more fun part is trying to spend other people's money. So we've been very involved with the Career Pathways Trust Fund administered through the Department of Education, with the superintendent playing a very key leadership role on that in the State Board of Education. We also are very involved with this the Strong Workforce Program administered through the Chancellor's Office. That's the $200 million that was just allocated to career technical training through the community colleges connected to K-12. It's important, I think, for us to point out, for me to point out, that these efforts, although significant in many ways, are not the system per se. The system in California is about a $6 billion annual investment in workforce training, education, and employment services, and the vast majority of those funds aren't spent from Sacramento. They're spent at the local level. So they're already programmed to help students and populations with barriers. Our effort is to do a kind of creative realignment, to use our dollars, pushing from the margins as much as we can, using policy levers we have in Sacramento, to change the way those dollars are invested at the local regional levels to get better employment impacts through scale for people who most need jobs. So the intent is to, I like to say it this way, to shift largely locally based programs that tend to be fragmented to locally based programs that are organized behind regionally defined vision, common goals and strategies, and that connect programs and program participants to employers that are driving regional employment, number one, and that provide good jobs, not just any kind of job, but good jobs that can support families. So we just completed the governor's new four-year strategic plan. We did that with all the state entities at the table, because as you know, workforce dollars, education, employment services dollars aren't invested through one department. It goes through six or more departments through 30-odd programs before it ever gets to the local level. So we've got to try to untie all our contribution to siloed funding as much as we can to get that kind of scale I talked about. We just released local regional planning guidance. Local regional plans are going to be due to us in early spring. And all of this is built around kind of four legs. One is the regional leadership focused on organizing local programs and then calibrating supply and demand so that skills match what's happening in regional labor markets, building industry sector partners so again, those programs that are doing great work and changing lives actually connect people, young people, directly to good jobs that are driving regional employment. Local program alignment, that's what we're doing with our state dollars in those programs I mentioned, getting different programs to kind of work together in collaboration, breaking down silos. And then looking at data and how we can do cross-system sharing of participant data so people, young people, don't get lost in our sometimes complex workforce development system. So I'll leave it at that because I think my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Next panelist, Ms. Sanders.
Is that working? Okay. Yeah. Leave it to me. I would pick the one. I knew when I sat here it probably wasn't a good choice, but thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Christiane Sanders. I am the Associate Director with the Division of Juvenile Justice, and I oversee the Juvenile Acceptance and Community Release Accountability Section. DJJ's mission is to provide opportunities for growth and change by identifying and responding to the unique needs of our youth, not only while in our care, but also when they discharge from DJJ. With the transition of supervision from DJJ parole to county probation, DJJ has recognized not only the importance of the services they receive while with us, but also the need for reentry planning as they transition back into the community. Because of this, the work with the youth begins before their arrival to DJJ. One of the beginning steps that we take upon acceptance is sending out a family reentry survey to gather information about the youth from their parents or caretakers so that we have a better understanding of the youth that is coming into us and the support systems that they had in the community so that we can utilize those supports while they're with us, because we definitely understand the importance of their support systems and community support systems and want to enable them to be utilized during their stay with us to continue that connection to family and to community while being supported within our system. The primary model that we have in place is the integrated behavior treatment model, and that model means that we all work as a team. Within the facility, they have their specific treatment team, which is composed of counselors with mental health staff and education. But we also encourage, again, the community support as well as family to participate in that planning process and to provide encouragement and support as the youth work to change the behaviors that brought them to DJJ. Each youth is assessed upon arrival. There's psychological assessments as well as an assessment tool that we use, which is the Cal-YAWSI, which pinpoints areas of high risk in behaviors that obviously we would want to address while the youth are with us. In addition to that, though, it also identifies the strengths that the youth possesses coming in that we want to be able to continue to focus on and harness and enhance while building other strengths to help them to manage and change their thoughts and behaviors that lead to negative outcomes. Each youth has an individualized treatment plan. We look at the overarching behavior, but one of the things that we definitely focus on is the underlying thoughts or feelings associated with the behavior, because the plans have to be unique to the youth and address whatever the thoughts or feelings are that lead to the behavior, and we want to make sure that we capture that so that it's specific to the youth and targets their change and doesn't lump everybody together into the same mold. So we develop a plan with the youth, and that's something that we have found has to be a critical component, is that the youth has to want to address the changes and start managing their behavior in a different way. So the relationship that the team has with the youth is critical, and it must be supportive in order for them to facilitate that change and want to move forward. We take into consideration the stage of change that they're in, as well as adolescent brain development, which we all know has a huge impact on their ability to reason and to want to promote change and to be able to internalize the information. So all of those factors are taken into consideration within the development of the plan. We also want it to be a successful experience for them. Changing, going from 0 to 100 is not realistic, and we want them to have attainable, achievable small steps and build off of success. And sometimes that can be a very simple step until they start mastering the skill of changing the behavior, and then we can move it on to bigger and better things. But we definitely want it to be a successful event for them and not something that is critical. And the treatment plans are updated to meet those changes and their needs and to adapt. If we need to move forward, we can do that, or we can move backwards. Cognitive behavioral interventions are used to target changing thoughts and behavior that lead to the negative outcomes and replacing those with positive beliefs and behaviors. Again, we want to tailor the plan to the youth, taking into consideration their different needs, whether it be language, disability, cognitive impairments, and make it specific to those youth so that they can succeed in participating in the interventions and making the changes. Also, we want to implement a modeling system so that they can see and practice those skills that we want them to learn and to develop. The thought of them coming up with that on their own and being able to do it just by reading it out of an assignment isn't realistic, and it has to be repetitive and it has to be reinforced. As part of the integrated behavior treatment model, we also have a behavior management system which does just that. The reinforcement system acknowledges those small changes and reinforces them both publicly and with incentives so that they are rewarded as they make these changes and they're acknowledged by their peers as well as staff and get the support that way. We also have a level system in place which rewards the changes in behavior, and with the increase in level, they also have increased in privileges and an increase in responsibilities. And ultimately, at the highest level, they begin to take on a leadership role in their community and become mentors to other youth. We also focus on education, getting a high school diploma or GED. We also focus on vocation, skills. We have forklift certification. Some kids are eligible to participate in fire camp as well. So those are the programs while they're in the facility. Some of our youth are going to be transitioning to adult prisons. So we have also worked in conjunction with adult institutions to participate in the youthful offender program to give them information about programming and services that are offered to them so that they can make different decisions and take advantage of those opportunities. Some youth come in believing that their program is going to be a certain way if they have to transition to adult corrections, and we want to give them the information that it doesn't have to be that way and that there are opportunities that they can be involved in as well. The reentry planning is also a key component. Working in collaboration with county probation is essential. They are the folks that have the information about the community services that are out there, and working collaboratively with them to have a comprehensive plan before the youth leaves our DJJ is critical. So we are working to develop and nurture that relationship and have increased communication and understanding as to each person's role so that the youth can leave us with a comprehensive plan and resources in place in the community. Thank you for the opportunity to present this morning.
You're welcome. Are there any members with any questions? I have hopefully a quick one. The National Medical Association was recently in Los Angeles, and that's all the African-American physicians across the country. And I had opportunity to speak with Dr. David Satcher. He was the 10th U.S. Assistant Secretary of Health. He was the 16th Surgeon General of the U.S. as appointed by Bill Clinton. He's a retired Vice Admiral. He's the Director of CDC, Center for Disease Control, past President of Meharry Medical College and Morehouse, and for our purposes, he served in the faculty of UCLA Medical Center, and I guess most importantly, Martin Luther King Hospital, and we discussed about gun violence in general, but about the impact of PTSD on our community, and that maybe, just maybe, as we move forward, we need to put a little more effort into the mental health of our young people and what they're going into. And because, as he said, yes, we can go ahead and give them the best education. We can go ahead and provide them good medical care. We can go ahead and provide them clothing and feed them. But if they're going into an environment which is almost like a war zone in Iraq or Afghanistan, it's really hard for a young person to concentrate when they've just seen someone murdered or killed, or there's drug activity going on, or they're being chased by gang members. And we want to kind of put them into a silo in which they just mentally may not be able to handle, because there's just so much pressure that even an adult would have a problem with. And so just generally, do you think that maybe our approach should be a little more mental health related as opposed to we still need all the other factors in the program mm-hmm. That we probably need to maybe step up our activities on the mental health side. Sure.
Chair, that's a great point. And our Office of Health Equity speaks regularly with not only Dr. Satcher, but his staff at the Satcher Leadership Institute and Morehouse School of Medicine. And his Sentinel mental health report during his tenure in the Clinton administration is partly what catalyzed the California Reducing Disparities Project and led us to securing the $60 million from the Mental Health Services Act to address these efforts. And our fundamental belief is that you have no health without mental health.
Thank you.
Kaiser Permanente tags it as total health. So it's mind, body, and spirit. And to invest more strategically with regard to mental health, not as a bifurcated condition, but as an integrated part of our whole health, is critical. Trauma-informed systems is critical, not just with regard to hospitals, but when we think about our schools, we think about other service institutions that address the needs of our community. And lastly, mental health with regard to toxic stress, it's a very real physiological issue that when people are stressed out, it's not only a psychosocial issue, but elevated cortisol levels in the body increases allostatic load and puts so much pressure on our organs. So when we think about disadvantaged communities that are either poor and or of color, there literally is a physical response to the mental and behavioral health trauma that our communities endure. So in theory, generally, we do need to invest more strategically and more into the mental and behavioral health needs of communities across the state of California.
I would agree. DJJ does provide mental health services specific to trauma-focused interventions. Albeit that is on varying levels, depend on the needs of the youth, but we are always open to looking at enhancing services and assessing the needs of the population to meet their needs, because I'm in agreement that it's an overarching plan that has to be in place to address all of their needs for them to be able to transition out and to be successful.
Thank you.
We are beginning our partnership with the Office of Health Equity, and we'll continue to grow that partnership. And so I defer to you on those comments. So I'm looking forward to our partnership.
Okay. You know, I just want to thank Chair Joan Sawyer for raising this issue as the chair of the Select Committee, as well as the Assembly member for the 18th Assembly District, which includes Oakland and Alameda and San Leandro. The issue of trauma-informed care and adverse childhood experiences, toxic stress, has been very important to this committee and to my district and other districts across the state. In fact, one of our priority bills this year for this Select Committee is AB 1644, which would help us bring back that early mental health initiative and have it focus on our youngest, most vulnerable children from preschool to third grade, and focus on ACEs and trauma-informed care. So we think that's a really important foundation. That bill is continuing to move through the process, and of course we continue to be hopeful. Are there other promising areas where you think the time is now where we can make a strong step forward to provide support for our young people who are facing trauma?
Yes, I think the workforce development piece is important, but if we go upstream in the life course, educational attainment. So 18%, according to the Federal Department of Education, 18% of our preschoolers across the country are African-American boys and girls, but 48% of the one-day school suspensions in preschool are African-American boys and girls, and this is preschool. So that literally ties to the workforce development because the pipeline is being constricted upstream. So it shouldn't surprise us by the time we get to third grade reading issues or many of our kids are being diverted to areas they should not be diverted to because oftentimes we have a culturally incongruent set of either teachers or administrators to some extent that could diversify demographically. But it's tied to educational attainment. So I think in general that is a key social determinant of health that needs to be addressed upstream. And as early as possible.
Thank you. I want to recognize and thank my colleagues, our colleagues on this Select Committee for being here. We have Assemblymember Cheryl Brown, Assemblymember Chris Holden, Assemblymember Tony Thurman, who are here, who have been amazing advocates and leaders on this Select Committee. And I believe that Mr. Thurman has a question or a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Mr. Miller, I wanted to just ask you if you would follow up on the statistic that you just gave about 48% of one-day suspensions in preschool being African-American males, I think you said. I can't get my mind around what one would have to do to be suspended in preschool. But if you could elaborate for what reasons are being given to push our children out of preschool. And I appreciate the connection that you made to literacy by third grade. You know, I have a bill, AB 1014, that addresses chronic absenteeism in California, that helps school districts to have resources to work with K-3 children who are chronically absent in a supportive way, to provide counseling, to address mental health issues, whatever the barriers are to their being in school, so that they don't drop out because they didn't learn to read by third grade. But help me get my mind around what you could possibly find, what reason could be found to suspend a preschooler 48% of the time. Could you help, please?
Implicit bias from a social science standpoint. A lot of work has been done to where there literally is a it's a demographic disconnect. So oftentimes, not all schools, not all school districts, but many teachers who come and teach in communities that may not be from that community, either geographically and or culturally. So the social scientist speaks to how administrators and or teachers see boys and girls of color psychologically different, and it's rooted in implicit bias. So, for instance, my personal story, when I was in third grade, I had a teacher, Mr. Young. He called me a dumb fool. And I don't know, I probably jumped off my desk or something. But the way that I was dealt with was different than probably one of my other colleagues. So there is an implicit bias. There's a psychosocial component of how we perceive others that plays out. So if that pipeline is stifled, we can't diversify the workforce and have more administrators who are culturally sensitive and congruent, there is this persistent gap and inability to deal with our children in more restorative ways. And there's a great body of work out there that speaks to that.
I don't know where that teacher is now, but who the dumb fool? I mean, I'm sorry. What I meant to say is...
and thanks to my mom and dad. They were at the school the next day. Bill and Yvonne were at the school the next day, so I didn't have any more problems out of him.
I'm sure you didn't, and I'm sure somewhere Mr. Young is regretting his actions. Who's the dumb fool now is all I have to say. To your point about the implicit bias, we've talked about implicit bias from the standpoint of addressing bias within our police departments towards African-Americans and people of color. And we've talked about using implicit bias training and procedural justice and other things. Are you suggesting then it's a similar type of training for the preschool educators to address that implicit bias? Are there other things that we need to be initiating to help reverse that trend?
Yes, I think the training and development piece is critical. My brother Darnell is an officer with College Park Police Department in Atlanta, and we talk extensively about not only the need to train and develop, but also we simultaneously build up that pipeline to diversify those who are actually serving, so that you have a nice mix of demography, of culture, training and development, because the systems, the institutions literally have to change. And in the private and public sectors, particularly when we look at the demographic composition of the 38 million people across the state of California, when you look at various corporate entities, state government, oftentimes those that we serve aren't, you don't see a balance, you don't see a reflection in the workforce. So there's a disconnect. But training and development is a key component, as well as literally diversifying over time the workforce.
Thank you, sir.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you to this panel for your participation and your insight and for being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to call our next panel up with a progress report from Southern California. We have Abraham Medina from Santa Ana Boys and Men of Color, David Celadon, Santa Ana Boys and Men of Color as well, and Juan Julio from Santa Ana Boys and Men of Color. And as our new set of panelists are coming up, I just want to take a moment of member personal privilege to thank and acknowledge five interns from my office who are up in the gallery for being here today and participating in today's hearing. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being here. Welcome. Whenever you're ready, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairman Bonta and John Sawyer, for your leadership on the Select Committee and all of you really here present, because we need elected officials that are taking initiative like y'all are doing, showing us the example. So with that, I also want to say that the issues that we're facing in Orange County have to do with the school-to-prison-to-deportation pipeline. My name is Abraham Medina. I am from Santana Boys and Men of Color. I grew up undocumented. Right now, I am documented. I'm also the director of this organization. And we're merging with other organizations like the Girls and Women of Color, RAIS, and the Youth Media Center to create a new organization called Resilience Orange County. And that's really rooted in what's the science around toxic stress and how do we really build resilience in our communities to generate transformation within ourselves, within our communities, and within systems. Because the situation, again, that we're facing is continued violence towards and intolerance of the LGBTQ community in our schools, in our community, in our justice system, unjust local policies that disproportionately impact undocumented communities. For example, to give a little context, before 2012, Orange County accounted for 43% of youth referrals to ICE in the state, second to San Francisco at 13%. We also have an issue in the juvenile justice system of racial and ethnic disparities. In Orange County, Latinos make 46% of the population, but in juvenile hall, 76%. Blacks make up 1% of the population, but in juvenile hall, 5%. So what we're facing in this situation is how do we really challenge that in our county? And so we started organizing in our communities to address those issues. By 2015, the number of youth referrals went from over 100 a year to 2, thanks to the work from the community. AB 899 was passed that prohibited probation department to share the information to minors with ICE. I am here also to thank you for your leadership around the data desegregation bill, AB 1726. And, you know, we need to also challenge the stereotypes that exist within the API community and look at those indicators. But we really can't look at them if we don't have the data, right? So I think that this bill will really help our communities. Orange County is the only county in the state that continues to have a 287G contract with ICE. And they just renewed it, which is also a challenge to our communities. The justice system in Orange County is in a dire situation, and we need to address it. The issue of procedural justice. The Orange County DA, district attorney, has been found to use informants unconstitutionally. The sheriff's department is also implicated in this. The sheriff's department has been implicated in Trust Act violations. There's a current investigation of the FBI on the Santana Police Department. There's constant violations of due process, and it's an issue in our communities, disproportionately impacting boys and men of color. That is why AB 1909 is really important in our communities and is currently in suspense in appropriations. The falsifying evidence should have accountability, and so AB 1909 is important. Also, AB 2298, the criminal gang bill, is also in suspension appropriations, and it seems that a lot of these bills end up in suspension appropriations. But if we're really serious about systemic change, is going to require that investment, and justice for our communities is worth our tax dollars. So I ask that that we also consider how our communities are building that resilience and generating transformation. And restorative justice is really transforming modern-day systems from the school system to the juvenile justice system. We want to look towards Prop 57 and the juvenile direct fine, the direct fine of juveniles. Eventually, we want to end juvenile incarceration. But we're starting with planting that seed within our communities of resilience and using restorative justice to transform these modern-day systems. Thank you.
Thank you. Next panelist.
Thank you. Hi, I'm David Celedon. I want to thank you guys for letting me be up here. I'm part of the Santa Ana Boys of Men of Color. I'm here for you guys to hear my story. So, there it goes. I was going to Santa Ana High School. When I was there, I got into a fight that they labeled as a gang-related incident, which was really an issue of someone spitting on my sneakers. The way they handled the fight should have been handled a different way. But instead of me finishing the RJ sessions, they ended up calling the police and made it worse. The police classified it as a gang-related fight, which led me to expulsion from school and having probation and ending up in a continuation school called Lauren Garcette Academy. When I got to that school, I felt like they put me in a school where the teachers could care less about what you do. I felt like giving up and dropping out of school. But my mom introduced me to the organization that I am now a part of. They invited me to meetings to implement restorative justice in the Santa Ana School District. Restorative justice has been implemented in 17 schools in my district. Right now I'm going to college, but I'm having a hard time sealing my record. I'm also here to ask that you help get AB2298 criminal gang bill out of suspense. And as a result of the school labeling it as a result of the school labeling my fight as a gang-related incident, I'm in fear that I was put into the gang database. I also ask that you pass legislation to help families and you seal the record. Because for a personal experience, right now I'm still in a six-month waiting list to seal my juvenile record. They told me once I turned 18 that I could just go and sign a paper, and they'll say that my record is terminated. I went, and they end up telling me that I'm still in the process, so it might be up to 6 months. And if in 6 months it's not sealed, then I'm looking into 3 more years of waiting. So then my fear is that it's never going to get terminated. Yeah. That's about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, we don't allow expressions, except we do allow this. So if you want to express clapping, this is our sign for clapping.
I want to recognize Assemblymember Eduardo Garcia for being here and for his participation and leadership on the Select Committee. And now very excited to hear from our final panelist, Mr. Juan Julio.
Hi. Good morning. I wanted to thank you all for the space and time to hear our stories. My name is Juan Julio, age 19, from Santa Ana Boys of Men of Color, Orange County. I'm here to share my story. I have been impacted by the deportation throughout my whole life. I remember growing up seeing my uncles, cousins, and their families go through the deportation process. I got to feel it in personal life in my home at the age of 12, at the beginning of my middle school years. My father, for nonviolent offenses, he was arrested and therefore deported because he's undocumented. It happened for the next 3 years, the beginning of every year of my school. So growing up, I didn't have my father at the beginning of my school. I remember growing up in a house with no father. I would have to look up to the older man in my community, my cousins, who were not into such positive activities. I was developing as a young man, and my father was not at home. He was either imprisoned or deported. So I looked up to my cousins. feeling hate and anger for the system that took my father away. I didn't do the best decisions for myself. I fell into this gang culture in the community. My father, by the time he came back home, to a totally different son, one that was raised by the streets and the pain within me. That was not the end. In my freshman year of high school, my mother, a woman of love, a woman who wouldn't hurt a bug, was wrongly arrested for working hard to provide for me and my two younger sisters. She was also deported. Due to that, my sisters had to move to Mexico for 2 years, in which they constantly suffered threats of violence, living in constant fear. Under these circumstances, I was forced to drop out of high school my freshman year. And I joined a hardworking force so that I was going to be able to provide to my family, to support them and my loved ones miles away. Due to the threats of violence, my sisters had to come back here. And soon I realized I couldn't do this on my own. I wanted a higher education to be able to support them even more. So I decided to go back to school. Once there, I encountered many, many obstacles, like no support from teachers or staff who saw me as another mess up in the community. I was always a straight A student in honors classes, but behavior-wise, I was always on the edge, full of anger, pain, resentment for what was going on. And they were not there to offer me any help or support, but instead they were pushing me out. They were pushing me away from school, suspending me for willful defiance, sending me to continuation school where even less support was offered to me. Fortunately, I found this restorative justice program and a Loringer State Academy called Joven Noble Circles, where my eyes were opened for the first time. I realized what was going on, not only just to me, but in my community and even greater all over the country. That's when I realized I was in the middle of World War III, and this whole time I've been unarmed without knowledge and armed with hate for my people. Realizing this, I got involved in making sure that there was going to be these restorative justice circles in other schools. I advocated and went to my district and fought for it, and we got it implemented in 13 schools to this day. Meanwhile, my mother had taken enough of living in fear, pain, and separation from her kids. She attempted to reunite with me and my sisters, but she was caught at the border and charged for trying to be a mother, responding to the cries of her infants, and was given 6 months in prison and put into deportation process once more. At this point, I had enough of the injustice going on, and I mobilized with my Boys and Men of Color and joined a deportation defense training in which I built my skills, my support system, and my networks to fight my mother's deportation. I advocated for policies that helped my mother's situation, going to speak to elected officials and sharing my story, like right here. I organized and raised $10,000 within months to get my mother out on bail. Before Christmas of 2013, I had brought my mother home and reunited her with my sisters. I'm here to ask that you prioritize ending collaborations between the ICE and local police departments in support of the SB 1289, which prohibits ICE contracts with our communities, to prioritize getting rid of juvenile court fees that I can't even pay with, going paying my college, working in a part-time job, and being undocumented. I don't know how I'm doing it. To prioritize addressing issues of police brutality and procedural injustice happening in my community, and not only in my community, but across the state. Me and my mother are still fighting her deportation case. Her next court date is coming up soon. If my mom were to be deported, I would be completely torn apart. Me and my two younger sisters depend on my mother since my father is no longer in the picture. I am asking you letters of support with support to help stop my mother's deportation process. I keep the deportation process to keep my family together, just like yours. Free my dream. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Julio, for sharing your story, and thank you to all of our panelists for being here today. The issue of local law enforcement agencies working with ICE to deport our community members is one that we're working on here in the Assembly and in the Select Committee. We have the Truth Act, which is moving through the Senate, which addresses this very issue. So thank you for spotlighting it and calling additional attention to it, and thank you for your very powerful and personal testimony. Mr. Julio.
Are there any questions from committee members? And I too want to thank you for your testimony. Since I've been here, I've been working on continuation schools. I've had two bills, AB 570 and AB 1573, because I noticed that continuation schools seem to be out of the mainstream. Not only are not properly regulated, ensure that you get proper education and that you matriculate through the system, I find that they are a vehicle to, as you put it, put young people from the school to prison, and it looks like to deportation pipeline. I guess I'll need to add deportation to that list. It is something that I think you've opened our eyes up to, adding the deportation part. And if you have any additional ideas on what we can do as a legislature to help curb that, obviously we have people outside this room who talk about building walls and deporting people, and we all have different ideas of how to handle that, and some of us are vehemently against any of that. And so in California, we should do a better job. If more important, we should be the shining light and should work to ensure that places like Santa Ana is not the harbinger of continuing this practice. And so I think I can commit members here that if you get information to us, addresses, we can definitely disseminate your struggle, Mr. Julio, to other members, so that we can get your message out, and hopefully we can help in some way. Any question? Okay. Thank you very much, your gentlemen. Your stories were compelling. Thank you for being here. I know it was hard sharing that, but you're two brave young men, and I'm proud that you're in the state of California. Thank you. Next panel is the Central California Progress Youth Report. Anthony AP or App Armour, Neighborhood Thrift, Eddie Chavez, Neighborhood Thrift, and Jesse Plata, Neighborhood Thrift. Gentlemen, whenever you're ready, you may begin.
Good.
This is good.
Awesome. My name is Anthony A.P. Armour. I'm the director of a Fresno-based organization, Neighborhood Industries. I've only been recently working with the Boys and Men of Color Initiative for about 3 years now. I won't take too much time. I'm just going to speak a little bit about what our organization does and then how we've partnered with the BLMOC Initiative and just kind of my experience in working with a specific population. We are a Neighborhood Industries is an organization that operates and manages a series of small businesses. It was kind of incarnated back in 2008, just a couple of knuckleheads, young guys looking to start businesses that can empower our community. That was, like I said, 2008. We were gifted about $18,000, and we've generated, I don't know, $4.5 million that have been circulating in the South Fresno neighborhoods. We believe that jobs are the vehicle for change. We believe that there's nothing more empowering than a paycheck. So we are in the business of creating jobs. We 2015, we generated, let me see here, 30 of our 70 participants. These are people aging age ranges of like 17 to 60 that are identified as hard to hire population. We work closely with the Fresno County Welfare to Work Program. So we're actually the second largest program placement for the Welfare to Work Program in Fresno County. We were approached, I think, 3 years ago by Sarah Reyes. I'm not sure if any of you guys know her. She's a very convincing woman. I was pretty skeptical at first about the BMOC initiative. The last thing I really wanted to do is work with a bunch of kids that were just going to be an extra headache. I already got 60 people on staff, and I'm trying to keep alive and keep going. But something about looking at them was like looking in the mirror, and I was thinking, you know what? Got to do it. Plus, Sarah would not leave us alone. So we committed to servicing 8 to 10 of them in a year in our program. And I got to say, man, it's like watching a miracle happen on a daily basis. Like I said, we had 30 people getting the jobs, or we feel are successful. We classify success as somebody sustaining their life, paying rent, making their car payment, not getting evicted, staying out of jail. Those are all things that we classify as successful within our organization. And, you know, since we've worked with the BMOC population, these are kids that are 16 to 24. We only employed 22 of them, or we only brought in 22 to our program. 17 of them are now successful. These are people that are not only sustaining their lives, they're living in their own apartments, they're being a father. These are people pursuing education. I got a guy just graduated as a physical therapist, bought his first house for him and his family. The paycheck itself is powerful. And you know, I think a lot of people ask us what our secret sauce or what our magic sauce is. And I think it's just being fair and equitable. You know, there's nothing more fair than competing in the job force. You show up, you show up. You know, if you don't, the answer is it's made itself. You know, like you're not ready. And I've seen these young men, just the tenacity to get after it. I look at young men, I look at myself in the mirror, and I see a person that wasn't given the opportunity as a kid. And I've been a brown guy for 32 years now, and all up and down this West Coast. And I remember the first paycheck I got on a dairy farm. I was 13 years old, and I realized if I can move heavy things all day, someone's going to pay me for it. I can do that the rest of my life. And luckily, I don't have to do that as often. But I see giving the same opportunity to young men like these guys. You know, they're taking care of themselves. There's nothing more, I guess, I can't emphasize enough how empowering it is to get our young men into the job force. I don't need to say much more. These two guys, they'll probably hopefully have good things to say. They just happened to be in Sacramento. I drove up yesterday. But I guess if I could challenge anything, I didn't really realize we're supposed to prepare a bunch of bills and stuff like that. But I would say if we can somehow redistribute our resources into not just education, not just mental health, those are incredibly important things, but how can we support the small businesses? You know, our organization itself, our annual budget by intention is only 20% generated from outside revenue sources. All of our services are provided through the revenue generated from our businesses itself. We're a nonprofit organization just like several others, but rather than asking people to open up their wallet or their checkbook, we just say, give us the stuff you're not using in your garage. We'll create jobs for it. I think there's been a lot of initiatives to give handouts in terms of subsidies and here's some money, put these people to work, but we're bypassing the job aspect. So I don't have a solution, but I would say whatever we can do to create jobs in California. I hear about billions and trillions, a bunch of zeros happening behind these numbers, but to be honest, I don't see too many of that trickling down into the Central Valley. So anyways, I'll let these guys do the real talking here.
Thank you. I believe Mr. Chavez is first.
Hello?
There you go.
All right. Nice to meet everybody. I'm Eddie Chavez. to share my story with you guys, I pretty much want to start off when I was on some drugs at the time. I wasn't really thinking straight, involved with some bad things, and I just wasn't on the right track, and my girl got pregnant, and I ended up getting locked up for a crime I committed 8 months before that I didn't finish my probation for. Got sent to county. After county, they realized it was a juvenile case, and 16 days later, they sent me to a juvenile hall. In the juvenile hall, I seen the difference between adults and youth. Like, I really got to see what the difference was. So that really helped me a lot. On top of that, I had people when I was in county telling me, they were looking at 25-plus years, telling me that I really need to change my act up. I mean, a lot of people can tell me to change, but if you've never been through, I've been through. It really don't mean nothing to me. And after hearing it from those people, it kind of got my head straight. So I went to juvenile hall. I met Barrios Unidos, Fresno Barrios Unidos, and that's where, like, everything started. I started, like, doing good, going out with organizations with my boy Carlos. Started doing anything he wanted me to go to, I was right there. I got myself situated to the point where, like, I understood what I have to do in life to try to make myself make it. So after Joven Noble, he introduced me to Boys and Men of Color. Boys and Men of Color got me a job with Neighborhood Thrift. And that could have been, like, the best thing that ever happened to me. They gave me a job. They helped me provide for my son. I can actually give my brothers money instead of asking for them. I've been planning a trip for months to try to take my family out on the beach on my expense, and I'm finally going to be able to do that next week. And the best thing about it is, like, it's all, like, thanks to them. And then my family's going to know that I changed and that I did good. But the thing I wanted to point out was, like, I did bad in, like, low grades. Like, from first to fifth grade, I was doing bad. So that probably means that there's a bed in prison for me. But it's never going to get to see me. And that's what I want to do. I want to get a lot of other people not to get to see that bed. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jesse Pata. I'm from Fresno. I'm representing Boys Men of Color. Ooh, I'm kind of nervous right here. But all right, yeah. Well, for me, on my freshman year, I started drinking a lot of beer. But then after that, I started working in the fields, and then I just told like myself, should I be still drinking, still like doing the bad things? And then a couple like days later, I started changing up. I just didn't want to work in the fields anymore, picking up oranges and peaches. And then after that, my brother introduced me to the Boys Men of Color. And after that, I had met Francisco, and Francisco kind of inspired me to like open up more, to like trust like people. Because I never like trusted people in there or at work, but now I do. And then for like basically working at Neighborhood Thrift, I kind of like learned you gotta have responsibilities, you gotta have power, and you gotta have knowledge. And for me, for responsibilities is if you don't do what your boss tells you to do, then you probably will get fired or something. And then for me, for power, so like I could like so I could control people, I started buying my first thing of gold as a ring, chains, earrings, grills. And after that, I started controlling people. And for knowledge, I'm basically gonna thank AP, because he kind of like he basically gave me skills to like basically focus on more on school. And later on, it's going to pay off. And then after that, having Neighborhood Thrift, now I got mostly like family encouraging me, They basically helped me out on homework, and now I got like more like time to spend with my family, and basically support basically like my mom, because I really don't like want her like to be working in the fields anymore. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Ms. Brown?
Now I can speak. Okay. And I say that because I know we have to move on with our panels. First of all, thank you. And thank you for bringing the business aspect. A lot of things. Whenever you have a paycheck, if you have a paycheck, then you look at life differently, because then you can afford the things that you may not be able to afford and take care of, like you said earlier, your family. I want to thank you, young men, for coming here and speaking your mind and speaking, more importantly, speaking your heart. And I want to thank you for doing what you're doing, because I heard you say some real important things. Important things like business is important. And I think that's one of the things. I have a select committee on small businesses in the Inland Empire. And we, too, are plagued by the issues that you talk about. But you did something about it. So thank you so much for doing it. Can you tell me what kind of legislation, what do you think it would take? Because we have I know Mr. Garcia is tomorrow having a hearing on GoBiz. And GoBiz is a government agency that looks at how they can help businesses. What kind of legislation or what can we do to promote more small business opportunities for that you can think of?
Oh, man, that's a pretty big question. I'm not like the most political dude around, but just in my experience in my city, I see inefficiencies in how these systemic things are. You know, it's just business as usual for the past 20 years. Our public transportation is pretty crappy, and no one's done anything about it. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's really hard for a small business to say, "What if I had a good idea to infiltrate the public transportation system?" There's no way I'm going to be able to show up toward City Hall and be like, "Hey, man, I got this idea. Let's do on this. Let's work on this together." There's so much red tape, so many hoops. Honestly, that's why we created the model of organization we did, is because, and this is no diss on government things or anything like that, but things aren't the most fast moving in these circles, and so I go to restaurants and I see. I don't no longer see young teenagers bussing tables and doing dishes and being the waitresses, right, and waiters. I see people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s taking these jobs. And, you know, the manual workforce, that's the perfect world for our young men. We got so many guys with big arms and big backs that are just waiting to do work, but no one's willing, mm-hmm, to give them the opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think the hardest thing for me and our city is that we try to advocate for our young men. It's like, hey, they might have a record, they might have made some bad decisions, but trust me, I've seen this person day in, day out for the past 6 months, year and a half, employ this person. So I'm not sure there's any legislation that can provide opportunities for other small businesses or incentives for other small businesses to employ some credentialed or vouched for young men, but I think just providing opportunities for small businesses to compete for sort of large business opportunities. I don't know if the answer is that anything at all.
But. No, you did. Right. You'd be surprised at how you did answer that, because it's cool, something, man, that we need around here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Mr. Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and certainly for all of you who have turned out today. And can I call you AP?
Yeah, my man. Go for it.
Make it easy. Let me just say that, part of the solution is being here and being able to advocate for the young men, as you've described, to raise issues, many of the issues that I think that we connect with you already on, because in our own communities we're dealing with a lot of the same issues, and that goes to the panel that was before us and all of the panels that we'll be presenting. But I think what's really important is to be able to find ways where we can collaborate. Mm-hmm. Some of it may be in legislation, and some of it may not be in legislation. And As I was reading through the description and the background on a lot of the young people who are part of your program, I read that Eddie here has an interest in carpentry. And so the thing that occurred to me is that our labor trades have apprenticeship programs, mm-hmm. and maybe part of what we can do is to start marrying some of the organizations that we are aware of together and to kind of link you together, because I know that these apprenticeship programs will give you the opportunity, whether it is in carpentry or other forms of trade, that allows you to start to develop ideas. And then part of how we can link that is that we're looking at ways of putting resources into building. Members of this committee have shown a tremendous interest and desire and focus to see more resources in our budget to create housing opportunities and to start. That means that someone's going to have to start building housing. Linking with the trades and with your organization and others, giving young men like Eddie an opportunity to link up with the carpenters as an example, to get him into that program so that he can start to really be focused in on the developing and honing those skills. I think those are things that we might be able to do as well. The governor wants to see more resources put into infrastructure and, mm-hmm. and roads and highways and transit projects, and so there are trade opportunities there as well. So I think that there's maybe, beyond legislation, there are other things that we may be able to do in partnership, this committee, Boys and Men of Color, beyond our ability to hear specifically the things that you're saying, to hear your testimony, heartfelt, and to be able to articulate that back to some of our members. This place should be filled with other legislators who maybe aren't even a member of this committee. In a lot of ways, you are preaching to the choir, and we feel it, and you know, we felt it before we got here. But there are some other members that need to be educated about what is really going on in the communities and where young boys and men of color are up against it in so many different areas. And so we have to continue to work on our end on how to get that message, when you shared with us through this hearing process, how we can effectively get that into the hearts and minds of some of our colleagues. But beyond that, I think that there may be some other things we may be able to do outside of the legislative process to link you with, as I mentioned, the trades, to try to see if we can get young men like Eddie connected to folks who can train him and get him ready to get him out there and start working.
Let's first guy get him, were you done?
Oh, I'm done. Yeah.
I don't want to interrupt, my bad, man.
No, it's okay, AP.
I agree with you 100%, man. But one of the major barriers is that there are these opportunities in the trades and stuff like that, but how often do we drive down roads and we see our construction workers, half of the labor force, is like on their cell phone playing Pokemon Go or something, and they're getting paid $25-$30 an hour. I think there's a disconnect between people that have the barriers, but maybe that barrier is just they don't have a driver's license, or maybe they graduated high school. I can't tell you how many people, all the hundreds of young men and women I've serviced over the years that graduate high school, can't read, can't do math, they don't have their driver's license because they can't take the tests. And so it's obviously there is a huge cycle, and I think it's in my opinion, two things. It's a taste for excellence in everything we do, and I think it's identifying where the actual issues and the actual barriers are. So yeah, I agree, man. I think those are awesome pathways, especially in Central California. We got the high speed rail. We're gonna need a whole force of welders, carpenters, stuff like that. But we got to get people, young men, women, willing to show up to work. Got to get them willing to work, and then we got to get them educated so they can do the things that they're asked to do.
Thank you, Mr. Thurman.
Yeah. So AP was talking about, like, I actually have a diploma in general contracting entry level, but nobody will give me a job. I applied so many places and nobody will give me a job because I don't have a GED. Neighborhood Thrift is actually paying for two tutors, one math tutor and one writing tutor for me, because that's where I struggle in the most. So I think that needs to happen is we need to get more programs that don't really worry about that, but will help you get your education at the same time, like Neighborhood Thrift, because they help me out. If I'm struggling, they're right there, and they'll help me out. And if I need to go to school or need to go do something for BMOC or FBU, they always work it out with me. And I think that's what, like, helps me out the most, is that they're flexible with me. And programs like that is what we need the most. And another thing is, like, if more people would be more acceptance and try to at least help you get your education instead of turn you down, I think we'd have a lot more people working right now.
Amen. Thank you. Mr. Thurman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Chavez, just on the last point that you made, that you're interested and you haven't made a breakthrough, I'm going to ask you to talk to somebody on my staff before you leave here today. I'm not in Fresno, but I do chair the Labor Committee, and we do know some people in the building trades. And so if it's helpful to you, we'd like to make the connection and see if we can help you make that breakthrough, and want to encourage you. I know that the chair was right. We have this practice about not applauding in here, but just listening to you, Mr. Chavez, Mr. Plata, and before that, Mr. Celedon and Mr. Julio, I just wanted to clap my head off because I appreciate hearing from the experts, but I love it when we hear from the real experts, and that you all have shared, you know, trying to overcome obstacles that have been put in your way, and that now you're helping other people. And so I just want to thank you. And I know, Mr. AP, Mr. Armour, that you said that there's no secret sauce to Neighborhood Thrift, but I'm interested in what you all might share about how it works, because some years ago we started an entrepreneurship training program. And we're working with young men and women who sometimes have been in risky situations. Because I have the personal belief that a young person who's hustling on the street and selling drugs, for example, is a natural entrepreneur.
I hear you,
and that,
man.
If you can do the hustle out there, you can do the hustle in here or in a business. But with a little bit of assistance and some mentorship and a product that won't hurt nobody or get you arrested or killed. And we started this program for entrepreneurs, for young people. But I'll just be honest, it has struggled mightily. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what I found is it's hard to teach somebody how to write a business plan when they're texting you at 4 in the morning and saying, tell them my mom just put me out, or I don't have anywhere to go, and, or you're dealing with life skill issues that make it really hard to focus on entrepreneurship. And so I'd like to ask if you could just say what it is about your model. I know a lot of the social ventures, you said you don't take any money outside of what you do in the operating business, but so many of the social ventures that we work with, they make money in the business, but they ultimately have to lose money and get it filled by grants, because the level of intensity that is needed to provide the life skills and the support for many of our young people who haven't been given the best opportunities. Could you tell us what it is that, you know, you all do, and if you have any suggestions that you might think might help us strengthen our entrepreneurship training programs?
Well, first of all, I got an incredible team, man. I got this this gal. Her name is Addie Carr. She's really the most important piece of this entire organization. A part of our model, our business model, we created a position. Not many businesses do this, but we created an in-house case manager. You know, she's a professional. She has her master's in social work. She's legit. She's a real. In fact, she's probably the Mother Teresa of Fresno County. But so I think that in itself is important. A lot of our people, they require one-on-one assistance. They need sometimes just an ear to listen. They need somebody to say, "Hey, these are the issues going forward. This is a phone number you need to dial." You know, like, okay, I need to sit here in my office for an hour and just talk about, you know, and explain to you what domestic violence is. You know, it's simple things of education coming from a one-on-one basis is extremely powerful for us. I think entrepreneurially, I think you hit it on the head, man. Too many of our young men and women, they understand the hustle of selling a gram at a time. But in the reality is, like, we need to learn the hustle of, like, keeping a job and going to night school. And, you know, the reality is in our state, not just our country, is that it's hard for brown people, man. It's hard to get a job. And you know what? It's not going to get any easier. We just have to work harder. And you show that you're sustaining your life with paying rent for a year, nobody can argue with that. You save money, put down in a house, nobody can argue with that. You buy your own car, no one can take that from you. Those are things that I think are so powerful. And I see not just our young men, but all of our staff. Like, I have a lady, she immigrated here when she's 25, single mom, four kids. She now has purchased a house. She's not just contributing for her kids, not just providing a atmosphere where they can go to college, but she provided braces, a vehicle for the kid to get back to school and not back and forth to school. And to me, like, there's zero excuse. I got a young knucklehead that comes in, I'm like, oh, I'm tired, I can't, I'm sorry, I'm late. I'm like, okay, let's put this in perspective here. You have summer school papers. That's really important. You know, like, your mom might ask you to clean. Okay, that's important. But let's look at your staff here. Let's look at your coworkers. this is a real example and real life perspective of they made it, so can you. So I think in the grand scheme of entrepreneurial spirit, you just got to provide experiences. You know, like, we can't all be Drake. We can't all go from 0 to 100 and be okay with it. You know, like, there's got to be incremental steps. No offense to Eddie and Jesse here, but when they first came to the program, they're not going to go straight into CEO offices. You know, they need to learn how to show up to work on time. You know, have too good of a time on the weekend. They still got to go to work on Monday. And I think then it's identifying what are the things they're already doing correct. We spend so much time saying, oh, you're a criminal. You didn't graduate from high school. So we'll just shove you underneath this rug and call it a day. But really it's saying, hey, you're a leader. You're a protector. You're a father. You're loyal. You can lift 25 pounds or 8 hours a day. You're an excellent warehouse guy. You can count to 10, operate a calculator, cashier. You know, so I think it's teaching people the things that they're already good at and then building off of that. For us, we were a slow, steady build. We're not the largest organization in the country by any means, but we try to provide a lot of quality over the quantity, I guess.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think it's interesting to use the example of CEO because we call the program CEOU. Oh. But if you're willing, I'd like to ask Mr. Lucian, who's here with us, he's part of our team, to talk with you and see if we can exchange ideas and to talk with you, sir, about your interest in making connections in your area with the local building trades, if you're interested.
And I'd like to add one more thing.
Yes, sir.
I know you said they don't have a secret sauce, but I think the secret sauce is love and support, because if you come to work to get paid, at least I never thrift when I go to work. I go to work to make a change, to help someone. You know, someone's going to need clothes that's in low poverty. Someone's going to need shoes. Someone's going to need something. You know, not everybody can afford all that brand new, like, dishes set or nothing like that. We got some right there neighborhood thrift at low prices. And that's what I go to work for, to make a change. If you come to work just to get paid, I don't think that's ever going to help anybody. You got to come to work to try to make a difference, actually be dedicated to what you're doing.
Thank you.
That's what AP and everybody in neighborhood thrift does.
Thank you for sharing that. And when you all said that you were nervous, I thought, I'm always nervous every time I speak too. So hopefully you all keep pushing, and next time you'll be speaking on this side of the microphone. Thank you. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chavez. And on that, we will end this panel. And that was excellent remarks. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And we'll bring up the next panel, our last panel, Northern California Progress Report. Mr. Paul Dawal, Francisco Rojas, and Sterling Gilder all are from Rise Youth Center. And I want the audience to know that we do see you. We do see your cards, which says, Free Our Dreams. Mm-hmm. You are seen. And I want to thank you.
Mr. Speaker, just before they start this next panel, I just wanted to introduce my academy. They've been riding on a bus all night to get here, and they are in the back, and they are from San Bernardino County, and they're from 5 different school districts. So there they are back there.
Welcome. Yes.
Chair, if I could, I'd like to also have a moment of personal privilege.
Sure.
We do have 3 interns who are here in the building today, but also just want to give a shout-out to the Rise Youth Center, who I'm honored to be their assembly person in the 15th District, and they've taught me a lot. I'm still in training, but they've taught me a lot about youth development, and it is an honor to have you here and welcome you to the assembly. Thank you.
Right. So whenever you're ready to begin.
Thank you. First, I want to appreciate just having us in the space, and I'm also honored to be here and representing a great organization that leads with love. So, my name is Francisco Rojas Meraz. I will be representing the City of Richmond and the Rise Youth Center. I'll be speaking about health in our community today to explain what we are currently facing in Richmond. Richmond has lots of history. We have the derivatives that originated from Richmond as well. Chevron has been there for years, and plus all of our crazy violence and everything else that we've been dealing with. So we carry that history with us everywhere we go. It's been passed down generations after generations. So it's just this big trend that's been going. There has been a lot that has also shaped and formed the city today. There is frustration in the community, wanting peace, seeking places and communities to call home and family. Richmond's reputation has been imperfect over the years, and people have tried to change the meaning of Richmond, but the good has not outshined our history. Today, my purpose is to share my experience with the positive achievements Richmond has met and has to offer, but we request improvement for our glitch systems of our local policy as well. It took murder cases for people to react and understand what Richmond needs in order to change and come together. A group of young people came together and organized with Youth Together to create a safe and neutral space in Richmond where young people could come in, interact, engage with other youths from all parts of Richmond. So this space was created in 2008, and it has took a lot from the community to make this space happen. But years after organizing, Rise was open. Rise since then has been providing a space for people to come and express, learn, and process trauma they hold within themselves. It is also a space for empowerment and growth in the future of Richmond. Over the years, Rise has learned Rise has learned to grow a lot over the years and think about health, and has been providing space for youth that was fought for in the early 2000s. For example, our community health department at Rise has held space for young people to come and talk about whatever they're going through, whether it's personal or overall community issues, the impact that has impacted them. There are numerous opportunities for young people to hear and spaces to talk, to heal from their problems. There's on-site therapy as well, healing circles and identity groups for young folks to take part of. The community health department has also done a good job of providing different types of programming to bring awareness about self-care and food justice. One specific aspect that I'm really thankful for and glad that the community health does is their awareness of self-expression and also healing. They've combined forces with the Media Arts and Culture Department at Rise as well to create different visual arts and poetry and spoken word programs to help youth find different ways of healing. So that's kind of how I came into their world. I came in through a photojournalist project. Give me one second. So I came in through there photojournalist project where we were able to just talk to with other youth that were going through similar problems as I was in the community, and we were able to grow together as a group and then empower to go out into the community and do the same thing. So this was definitely a healing process, not only for us but for other young people in Richmond. So there's like little small programs and just spaces that we hold that are really like uplifting for people and young people in the community. So I also wanted to talk about our education system and how it's underserved, and we can't afford to provide resources for young people to be able to heal at school. So that takes a lot for a school to like really turn their gears and understand what health is, and also like what healing is and what it takes for someone to be sane enough to like really go out and teach others and help others heal. So I feel like training is involved, should be involved in education, and it shouldn't be an opportunity or an option. It should be a priority for the schools to really not only run the school, but like figure out how they could provide spaces for young people to really heal and for them to understand what problems are going on in the community as well. So that's what I want to offer. Thank you guys. And my voice is just one from Richmond, and I send my peace.
Thank you, Ms. Sterling.
So let me start by saying that I'm really honored to be here and honored to represent the RISE Center. My name is Sterling Gilder, and my purpose for speaking today is to inform you of the state of my of health in my community. Richmond is really unique, but also really similar to cities all across the state. While Richmond is capable of greatness and prosperity, there are a lot of disadvantages standing in their way, in its way, such as gun violence, sex trafficking, and poverty. My goal for today is to unveil the positive elements of our city has to offer and to demand improvement of our clearly damaged system of local policy. I'll give a little history like Francisco did. In 2000, a series of homicides rocked our city. In response to these tragedies, a group of young people set out to provide space for other youth to process trauma, to heal from systematic injustice, and, if desired, become advocates for their city and for themselves. The outcomes of their efforts resulted in the establishment of the RISE Youth Center in 2008. RISE, now approaching its ninth year of service to the community, works to expand and provide tools for our youth to succeed and to succeed. Personally, I came into the RISE Center as a youth when I was in high school, and I can't say how much it helped. It helped me graduate. It helped me get a job. And honestly, I wouldn't be where I am now without it. Over the years, it's been brought to RISE's attention that mental health is a pressing concern amongst youth. In reply to this feedback, we've been working with other organizations to rectify this issue and to implicate positive culture around mental health around the center. Our CHD department specializes in the psychological well-being of our young people. To emphasize this, CHD holds spaces for processing tragedy, the importance of self-care, and drop-in counseling. Beyond that, we also take into consideration that our youth aren't the only people in Richmond who are dealing with trauma. So some drop-in hours and events are open to the public as well. While these are really incredible strides towards improving our community, there's a lot more that has to be done. One example of needed improvement is our school system. Speaking as a graduate from a Richmond school, I must say that there are many times I felt unsafe, unsupported, and quite frankly alone. Many of my teachers were disinterested and inadequate for the job. The principal was disconnected from the students and the culture of the school, and the school to prison to deportation pipeline was really visible and apparent. When talking to my friends from other schools about this, I'm shown that their experiences heavily reflect mine. Moreover, the connection between violence and poor mental health in low-income communities is incredibly evident across the country. According to the U.S. Office of Minority Health, Black people of all ages are more likely to become victims of violent crimes than white people. Because of this, African Americans are more likely to meet the diagnostic criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. Another statistic calculated by the same organization notes that Black and brown teenagers are more likely to attempt suicide than white teenagers. People of color make up approximately 65% of Richmond, promoting this relation between mental health and race. Contrary to what city officials report, street violence in Richmond hasn't decreased as much. The amount of homicides in North Richmond aren't fully accounted for due to an ongoing issue of authority jurisdiction. We can't ignore the trauma that young people go through from this violence. Richmond isn't the only neglected community in California. Hundreds of young people in this room come from communities like mine. From my time at the Building Healthy Community Sisterhood Retreat and the Queer and Trans Youth Summit, I've learned how similar these cities are to Richmond. Because of this, I know that we're only one of many cities in California in need of improvement. So we ask that you listen and reflect. If we work together to create better state policy, place more money towards suffering and outdated programs, and take the ideas of young people into account, I believe that lives will be improved. I call to action a reform of policy around our schools and ask that more money is put towards mental health and self-care focused programming for youth. The best way to secure a better future for our society is by investing in young people of all different ethnicities, genders, and sexual orientations. We must give them the safety and justice that they are entitled to. Thank you.
Thank you. Next. That's the one that's broken.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Kanwarpal Dhaliwal, and I'm the Community Health Director at the RISE Center. Also just want to appreciate the opportunity to come here, represent Richmond, Northern California. And also I'm just humbled that I get to go last and really just bask in sort of the resilience and the fortitude of the stories we've heard amongst all these panels. And I feel like if I can say anything as an adult who works in service to young people and to health and justice and liberation for young people, it's that young people actually know what they need.
Yes.
If we give them the space, the time, pay attention to the language and the modes of expression that they can tell us their needs. And so for RISE, we consider ourselves a public health organization. And so we work along the ecological model of health, individual, community, system, structures. And if I can offer anything here around recommendations and what we might be able to do in partnership, is really looking at the ways in which, while we understand more and more that it's social determinants of health, it's structural conditions of disease, our interventions and our investments still require young people to change their behaviors. So we're still really focused on changing behaviors without changing the conditions of violence, of isolation that young people have to navigate. And so what that means is that everything from research to funding to policy making to even how we're able to express ourselves in rooms like this matter. When we feel the feeling and we can't express it, it stays in our body. And for young people in Richmond and West Contra Costa County, what we know is that the violence and the trauma they experience is atmospheric, that there's no place that they can be guaranteed or can help to predict that they'll be treated with love, dignity, and respect. And we know that because we actually engage in our own research, community-engaged research, which you have in your packets, where we talk to over 500 young people about these experiences of trauma, of violence, of coping, of healing. And what we heard over and over again, or what we didn't hear whenever we asked about these experiences, was a pause. So when we asked young people, tell us about violence and trauma, it was like, well, tell us what you want to know. Trauma by the schools, by the police, in our homes, on the streets, when we're coming to RISE, when we're going to Wingstop, when we're going to Target, what do you want to know? And we know this isn't the case in all communities. So we know trauma impacts everybody. We know trauma affects all health outcomes and indicators, but we also know that Black and brown young people are treated differently. They don't get the same empathy. The trauma and the pain is criminalized, stigmatized, and punished. And those are the kinds of things that need to change. And so for us, being able to do community-engaged research, listening with love, listening actively, so that those stories and those articulations then get translated into policies, practices, and investments, not just by RISE, but by our community of stakeholders, which includes our elected officials, our funders, our public systems. I just want to also emphasize that right now, you know, our work is certainly to shape and support and guide how young people engage in their daily lives, how they can make the best decisions in light of, in spite of, the harm and the dehumanization that exists for them. And much of that is systems created. And I really appreciate the term passive-aggressive racism, because I feel like there's this passive-aggressive trauma that systems are so complicit in. And that includes the service provider system. So I see myself as part of that and have a responsibility to name and really lift that up and shift that. But we have recently, just over the last 3 weeks and the last month, our police department knowingly kept school resource officers while they're under investigation for sex trafficking. It's called a sex scandal, but it's sex trafficking. No other organization, no one actually stood up and said, at least while the investigation is going on, let's get these officers out of the school. And so those are the kinds of harms. What does it say to our young people where you can get let, you know, if you drop a pencil wrong, you can get detention, but we're going to let those responsible for you who've been implicated in something actually stay. The same thing with our city council. We went through the democratic process of going through a ballot initiative to gain all the signatures we needed to put an initiative to create a fund for children, family, and youth. We did everything right. And unfortunately, our city leadership, including our mayor and our city council, opted out of facilitating democracy and due process and refused to put it on the ballot for this fall. So those are also the kinds of systems harm. So those responsible for us, responsible for these policies, practices, and investments for the young, for the well-being of young people, keep showing us they don't care. So what we're calling on is a way to really ensure that we're actively listening, listening with love, through research, through practice, through investment, and through relationships, so that one day we can be clapping in these halls and it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments or questions from committee members? Assemblymember Thurmond.
Ms. Brown. I just wanted to say on the clapping part, I agree with you. When I first came, I did clap. I did all those things. But there's a difference in how you look at this particular institution. And so we have to learn the differences, and maybe we clap someplace else. I had to learn that because I'm very demonstrative, I guess you could say. And I used to come in and act a lot differently than I do now. And they said, you know, this in this place, this is the way we do it. So maybe there has to be a difference. You do things one way whenever, like your mother said, you have your outside voice, and when you're inside, you have your inside voice. So I think that that, and I hope that we didn't offend whenever the chair said that that's the way it's done here in Sacramento. Didn't want to offend anybody. But do know that I've been there and I've done that. I understand. I understand all that you've spoken. And I thank you for coming because you have really, really put something on my mind. And I'm going to go back and sit down and kind of decompress because this has been a real good time to learn about those issues. I'm facing the same thing in my community. We had a 9-year-old boy and his father walk to the store and be shot and killed. And that was just a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. It wasn't in my district, but it was in the town that I live in. Mm-hmm. So we know that there's trauma. My grandson had been mistakenly thrown down on the ground by the police officers. He's in trauma. Mm-hmm. So we have to get some help for him, and we're working on that now. Mm-hmm. I understand that part of it. We just have to know how and what we can provide here to help to alleviate some of the trauma. Because we give all of the we give them the behavioral health money, the mental health money that comes to your community. Yeah. How is your community using that money?
Can I say something to that? I really want to appreciate RISE as a community mental health organization as well. We receive Prop 63 funding, OJJDP funding. It is not lost on us how critical that kind of funding is to us so that we can actually try things out that are more relevant and reflective of the context and priorities and needs of our young people. One thing I can tell you that would be really helpful is to many of our state contracts require that we use evidence-based practices, And that requires us to do triple the work, because we have to code switch to show you how we did it while we do other work. I would really like to elevate those, the community grounded and community built evidence that then gets actually translated into investments and policies. So we think that is one place that we can certainly work together to shift the kinds of legislation that requires that, that does actually create a hindrance for how we do the work.
So say that again. Tell us.
Someone want to talk about
No, that? You said community-based models rather than...
Community-built evidence versus evidence-based practice.
Okay, community-built evidence. Okay. Thank you.
I want to invite folks who want to make public comment to start coming up and line up at the microphone if you wish. And as you do that, we'll go to Assemblymember Thurman.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. It's fantastic. And I appreciate the depth that you shared, Ms. Gilder, Mr. Rojas, and Ms. Dhaliwal, of listening to Youth Voice. And I know it's been my honor to work with RISE for many years, including to help start the Youth Commission that works in the same school district that you talked about, that I understand is still doing good work to provide that youth voice. But clearly our work is not done. And the city of Richmond, I know, recently received a state grant that is for RISE, if they haven't told you.
We're trying to figure out how to access it. You can help us.
I think we can help you with that. As the primary author of that work, I think we can help you with that. And I bring it up because I heard what you said about not having to necessarily use only evidence-based practices for your reporting. Mm-hmm. And if we can figure out a way to be creative mm-hmm. in how we hear the stories. I'm reading for the first time the community survey that were youth-led. If there's a way to incorporate that, mm-hmm. We'd like to work with your office and whichever agency is ultimately administering the money to see how to do that. And so I think that we can do that. There's so many things that you all touched on. I know we just don't have time to get into all of it, and we can do that offline and in the district. I do want to come back to what you raised about the issue with the police department and in particular the school resource officers. And right about the time that really devastating news was reported, we got contacted by a local media outlet that shared that there is a really awful trend in the state of California where school resource officers are being used to criminalize kids on campus mm-hmm. for things that are just kids being kids.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that these kids find out later, and their families, that they actually have a record.
That's
for
right.
things that should have been managed through the school community process, whether it be some restorative justice or some other form of appropriate discipline, but not sending an officer to discipline a first grader mm-hmm. or to give someone a record who carved their name on school property. And so we've been asked to work closely with the School Resource Officers Association to look at the possibility of legislation to require best practices and evidence-based practices. Here we go again.
Here we go.
That mean that officers get training and that schools get training on how community policing or school-based resource officers are supposed to be used in a proper way to prevent harm or against students in the community, as opposed to criminalizing kids who are just being kids. And I'm asking this or raising this to ask if RISE and others would work with us in this conversation with the California School Resource Officers Association to explore how to make this better throughout the entire state of California.
Yeah.
I see a lot of head nodding.
Yes.
I saw a little bit of this.
Yes.
And,
yes. Yeah. I mean, we, you know, I can speak for RISE in that we believe in healthy struggle. That's how we believe liberation will really happen for all our peoples. And so we always remain open to being in partnership, especially when it might feel difficult, because that's where the transformation, the opportunity lies. So let's start. Let's do it.
And I know it's a difficult conversation because there are many who believe that there should never be a police officer on campus, and I get that. You know, as a parent of a student in the district who still live in Richmond, you know, there's nothing worse than getting a phone call from your child saying, don't freak out, but there are guns on campus today and we're in lockdown. Mm-hmm. And so as difficult as I know it is for some to even have the presence of officers there, you know, we're balancing many things, and as you said, the conversation might have struggle, but I would love to have help from RISE and other partners in talking about how to make this a positive resource on our schools. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again. to this panel. Thank you for your contributions and your insight and sharing your stories. We're going to go to public comment. We're actually a little over time, but we are going to have our public comment. And then we'll allow folks, if you have anything urgent to say to close out, you're allowed to. But maybe my fellow chair and I will just close it out briefly after public comment. Let's go to public comment.
Okay, cool. So, hi, I'm Rita. So, when I was listening to a lot of the panelists and also you all speaking, there was a lot of talk about evaluation, implementation, and all these things that's going on that have been happening for years and things of that sort. But my question is, whenever I think of, low-income people and the people who actually need these jobs and need these services, and I always think about them, and it's also there's so much distrust between that population and then the government itself. And don't get me wrong, the government does provide a lot, but at the same time, they also feel... And, also coming from, being a person who's been a part of those services, that there is this part where there's so much distrust where it's I don't understand, if there really is going to be a way in which people, where the implementation that you're talking about is actually going to, work for them, because, there is that part where it's do I give them all this information? Is it really going to help me? Is my background going to affect me in this way? And things of that sort. So how is it that the actual... How is it that the implementation is going to be a reality rather than in theory? Because that's why I feel a lot of what a policy is more theoretical rather than actual. And so that's really my question. How are we going to make this realistic and stop living in theory and start being about, this is how we're going to do this? And I understand that change is gradual. It is. But at the same time, we're going through a lot right now. And how do we deal with that right now?
That's a great question. I'll just share a couple of reflections that I was thinking about as you asked it. I understand the distrust. It's the reality. It exists. We need, that I've chosen a career in government. I know a lot of my colleagues have as well, because we believe we can bend the arc and move the needle and create change. And part of it is earning the trust as government folks. I can't speak for all government, but I'm someone who believes in what government can do to improve people's lives by being more sensitive, more open-minded, more inclusive. I think what we have here in this specific partnership is a great start, because we are government leaders working hand in hand with grassroots advocates and everyone in between up and down the state to create real change. I mean, we're accomplishing what we've accomplished things already. I mean, we've gotten some important work done on willful defiance and ban the box. We did that together. Grassroots activists, youth and their adult partners and leaders throughout the state, sharing a common set of values with legislators who moved real policy change to make a difference in people's lives. And a lot of the bills that we talked about today, from AB 1644 and the Truth Act and other items that were mentioned, we're working on again. I think through that partnership, we can forge and build a new type of trust so that going forward, it won't have to be the same. So okay. Those are just a couple of reflections. I don't know if that answers the entire question, but I think we're moving in the direction and leadership is starting from this committee and our alliance and from all the youth leaders that were here today.
Okay. Good. You did good. You never talk past the yes.
Cool.
Okay, so we had one powerful public speaker and on public comment, and with that, we're going to close out this hearing. Thank you again to all of our amazing youth. I know they've started moving towards the rally, and we'll be joining all of our leaders at the rally as well. And thank you for making today a powerful day of personal stories and insight and exchange of ideas to help move our community of boys and men of color forward. Thank you.
And I want to quickly say I've learned a lot. As someone who went to a junior high school in South Los Angeles, where one of the original founders of the Blood Gang went to school. We went to middle school together. And we had a practice of where you wore your white chucks, somebody stepped on it and scuffed it, it would result in a scuffle. I know now, if I were doing that now, I would have a record and probably wouldn't be sitting up here right now. But we had individuals, we had administrators, we had people who understood that sometimes young males do things that aren't really smart, but you need to just break them up, talk to them, and we got a lot of people talking to us to get us on the right track. If it weren't for those counselors, administrators, vice principals, nurses, and school counselors, I don't think a lot of us would be here. Obviously, some slipped through the cracks, but I will tell you, there were many, many more that became productive members of society. We need to rebuild that infrastructure that was there before. And so this committee is committed to that, to rebuilding that infrastructure so our boys and men of color can be successful. Thank you.
Thank you. We're adjourned.